The cave helped out when you were young.
Why didn't you find another man to mate?
Mardina asked.
Why didn't you?
Her mother countered.
You know why. I had Lanadar, who would be interested in me.
Don't blame it on Lanadar. That's what you always say, but you never tried, Mardina. You didn't want to get hurt again.
It's still not too late,
the older woman said. They didn't notice the man approaching.
When Marthona told me the ninth cave had visitors this morning, I thought the name was familiar. How are you, Denoda?
Delinar said, taking both her hands in his and leaning forward to rub cheeks as though she were a close friend. Mardina saw a little color rise to her mother's face as she smiled at the tall, handsome man, and noticed that she seemed to hold her body differently. There was a womanly, sensual quality about her. Suddenly she was seeing her mother in a new light. Just because she was a grandmother didn't mean she was really so old. There were probably men who would find her attractive.
"This is my daughter, Mardina, of the 19th cave of the Zelandanyi,"
Denoda said,
"and my grandson is around here someplace."
He offered his hands to the younger woman. She took them and looked up at him.
"Greetings, Mardina of the 19th cave of the Zelandanyi, daughter of Denoda of the 19th cave. It is my pleasure to meet you. I am Delinar, leader of the first cave of the Lanzadanyi. In the name of the great Earth Mother Dani, please know that you are welcome to visit our camp any time, and our cave, too, for that matter."
Mardina was flustered at the warmth of his greeting. Though he was more than old enough to be the man of her hearth, she found herself drawn to him. She even thought she heard a certain emphasis on the word pleasure that made her think of the mother's gift of pleasure. She never felt so overwhelmed by a man before. Dalinar glanced around and saw a tall young woman.
"Joplea,"
he called, then turned and spoke to Denoda.
"I'd like you to meet the daughter of my hearth," he said.
Mardina was astonished by the young woman who approached. She was not as completely foreign-looking as the tiny woman, though there was a resemblance, which made her almost more unusual. Her hair was nearly as dark, but with lively highlights. Her cheekbones were high, but her face was neither as round nor as flat as the other woman's. Her nose resembled the man's, but was more delicate, and her black eyebrows were smooth and finely arched. Thick black lashes outlined eyes that were quite different from her mother's, though they were similar in shape, if not in color. Joplea's eyes were as distinctly colored as the vivid blue eyes of the man beside her, but hers were a brilliant shade of green. Mardina hadn't gone to the summer meeting when Dalinar's cave came the last time. The man of her hearth had recently left, and she didn't want to face people. She had heard of Joplea, but hadn't met her. Now that she had, she felt a compelling urge to stare and struggled to control it. Joplea was an exotically beautiful woman. After Dalinar introduced Joplea and greetings were exchanged, along with a few pleasantries, they left to talk to someone else. Mardina was still feeling the warmth of Dalinar's presence and began to understand why her mother had been so captivated by him. If he had been the man at her first rites, she might have been as entranced. But his daughter, while unusually lovely, had an air of melancholy about her, a despondency that belied the joy of an impending mating. Mardina couldn't understand why someone who ought to be happy could seem so sad.
"We need to go, Mardina," Denoda said. "We don't want to overstay our welcome, not if we want to be invited back. The Lanzadanyi are close to the ninth cave, and it's been many years since Dalinar and his cave have come to a summer meeting. They need to renew their ties. Let's find Lanadar and thank Ayla for inviting us."
The camps of the ninth cave of the Zelandanyi and the first cave of the Lanzadanyi were, ostensibly, two camps of two caves of two different people. But actually, it was one very large camp of close family and friends. Walking through the main camp toward the Zelandanya Lodge, the four women were a compelling sight. People didn't even try not to stare. Marthona was always noticed wherever she went. She was a former leader of a major cave, and still powerful, not to mention an attractive older woman. Although some people had met or seen Jerrica before, she was still such an unusual-looking woman, so unlike anyone they had seen before, people couldn't keep their eyes away. The fact that she was mated to Dalinar and had co-founded with him not only a new cave but a new people made her even more exceptional. Jerrica's daughter, Joplea, the dark-haired, melancholy beauty who, it was rumored, planned to mate with a man of mixed spirits, was a woman of mystery and speculation. The beautiful blonde woman that Jondalar brought back, who traveled with two docile horses and a wolf, and was rumored to be an accomplished healer, was probably some kind of foreign Zelandani. She spoke their language clearly, if not perfectly, and she had recently found a new and beautiful cave right under the nose of the 19th cave. Together, the foursome brought more attention than usual, but Ayla was learning to ignore it, and was glad for the company. Many people had already arrived when they reached the Zelandania Lodge. They were observed carefully at the entrance by several Zelandania who were men, which made Ayla curious. As if Marthona knew what she was thinking, the woman explained, "Men are not allowed at this meeting unless they're Zelandania, but every year there are always a few young men, usually from the Falages, who try to get close so they can listen," she said. "Some have even attempted to sneak in dressed up as women. The male Zelandania act as guards to keep them away." She noticed several more men who were Zelandania standing around the large structure, Madraman among them.
"What are Falages?" Ayla asked.
"The Far Lodges, the men's lodges. People always slur it to Falages. They are summer lodges built around the edges of the summer meeting camp by men, usually young men, who are past the need for a Danyi woman but not yet mated," Marthona said. "Young men don't like to stay with their caves. They'd rather be with friends their age, except when it's time for a meal." She smiled. "Their friends don't restrict their behavior the way their mothers and their mothers' mates do. Unmated men, especially of that age, are absolutely forbidden to go anywhere near the young women who are getting ready for first rites. But they always try, so the Zelandania keep a close watch on them when they're in camp. In their own lodges, if they construct them far enough away, they can be rowdy and loud, so long as they don't disturb other people. They can have gathers and invite other friends, and young women, of course. They become very good at badgering their mothers and her friends for extra food, and they always try to get barma or wine or whatever. I think it becomes a competition to see which lodge can entice the prettiest young women to visit them. There are also falages of older men, usually those who have no mates for one reason or another, men who prefer other men, or men who are between mates, or who wished they were and want to get away from their caves or families. Larimar spends more time at a falage during summer meetings than he does at his own lodge. It's where he trades for his barma, though I don't know what he does with his trades. He certainly doesn't bring anything home to his family. Men who are to be mated spend a day or more at a falage with the Zelandania before the matrimonial. Jondalar will be going soon, I think. When the four women first went in the Zelandania Lodge, with only the light from a fire in the central hearth and a few lamps, it felt dark inside. But when her eyes adjusted, Marthona looked around and then led the others toward two women who were sitting on a mat on the floor near the wall on the right side of the open central area. The women smiled when they saw them coming and moved over to make room. "I think it's about to start," Marthona said as they were sitting down on the mat. "We can do formal introductions later." She spoke to the ones who came with her. "This is Proliva's mother, Velima, and her sister, Lavila. They are from Summer Camp, the west holding of the 29th cave." Then to them, "This is Dalinar's mate, Jerrica, and her daughter, Joplea. The Lanzadanyi just arrived this morning, and this is Ayla of the 9th cave, formerly Ayla of the Mamutoi, the woman Jondalar plans to mate." The women smiled at each other, but before they could exchange many words, they noticed a hush settling over the assembly. The one who was first among those who served the Great Earth Mother and several other Zelandanya were standing in front of the group. Conversations stopped as the women became aware of them. When it was totally silent, the Danyar began.
"I am going to be speaking of very serious matters, and I want you to listen carefully. Women, you are the blessed of Dani, the one she created with the ability and privilege of bringing forth new life. To those of you who will soon be mated, there are some important things you must know."
She ceased speaking and made a point of looking at everyone there. When she saw the women with Marthona, she stayed for a moment. There were two here she hadn't expected. Marthona and Zelandani nodded to each other. Then the one who was first continued.
"At this gather, we will be talking about womanly things, how you should treat the men who will be your mates, and what you can expect from them, and about having children. We will also be talking about how not to have children, and what to do if one starts that you're not ready for,"
the large Danyar said.
"Some of you may already be blessed with the first stirrings of life. Yours is a special honor, but the honor carries with it a great responsibility as well. Some of what I will be telling you, you've heard before, especially at your rites of first pleasures. Listen carefully, even if you think you already know what I'm going to say. First, no girl should mate until she has become a woman, until she has started her bleeding and has had her first rites. Notice the phase of the moon on the day your blood first starts. For most women, the next time the moon is at the same phase, your blood will flow again, but it may not always stay the same. If several women live in the same dwelling for some time, often their moon times will change until their blood courses together." Some of the younger women looked around at their friends and relatives, especially those who didn't know of this phenomenon. Ayla had not been told of it, and she tried to recall if she had ever noticed it.
"The first indication that you have been blessed by the mother, that she has chosen a spirit to blend with yours to start a new life, will be when your blood does not flow at your phase of the moon. If it doesn't flow the following moon, you may begin to assume that you have been blessed, but your moon time should be missed for at least 3 moons, and you should have other indications before you can be reasonably sure that a new life has begun. Does anyone have any questions about this?"
There were no questions, except for being told that women who lived together tended to bleed at the same time. It was all repetition.
"I know most of you have been sharing the mother's gift of pleasure with your promised, and you should be enjoying it. If you aren't, talk to your Zelandani. I know it can be hard to admit such a thing, but there are ways to help, and the Zelandanya will always keep your secret, all your secrets. Except for young men just into their full maturity, it is wise to remember that few men can couple with a woman more than once or twice a day, and less as they get older. There is something you should be aware of. Sharing pleasures with your mate is not required if that is what you choose and your mate does not object, but most men will object. Most men will not stay with a woman who will not share her gift with them. Though you are preparing to tie the knot and may not imagine it now, the knot can also be severed for many reasons. I'm sure you all know someone who severed the knot with a mate."
There was some shuffling, changing of positions, glancing around. Most everyone did know someone who had been mated to a person they were no longer with.
"It has been said that women can make use of the mother's gift to hold their mates by keeping them happy and content. There are those who claim it was given to her children for that reason. That may be one reason, though not the only reason, I'm sure. But it is true that your mate will not be as tempted to look with pleasure upon other women if you satisfy his desires. He will be happy to save those fleeting moments of interest in someone else for ceremonies that honor the mother when it is acceptable and pleasing to her when pleasures are shared. But remember, though it can be a welcome diversion, anyone can accept or reject any offer to share the mother's gift. Sharing pleasures with someone else is also not required. If you and your mate are happy and joyfully share her gift with just each other, the mother is pleased. It is also not required to wait for a mother ceremony. Nothing about pleasures is required. It is a gift from the mother, and all her children are free to share it with whomever they like whenever they wish. Neither you nor your mate should be concerned by each other's passing diversions. Jealousy is far worse. Jealousy can have terrible repercussions. Jealousy can cause violence, and violence can lead to death. If someone gets killed, it can lead to revenge by the loved ones of the person who died, and more revenge in return, until there is nothing left but fighting. Anything that threatens the well-being of the children of the mother who were chosen to know her is not acceptable. The Zelandanyi are a strong people because they work together and help each other. The Great Earth Mother has provided everything that we need to live. Whatever is hunted or gathered is given to us by Dani and in turn should be shared by everyone. Because accepting what she offers can be hard work and even dangerous, those who give most gain the greatest respect. That is why the best providers and those who are willing to work for her children have the highest status. That is why leaders are so respected. They are willing to help their people. If they were not, people would no longer turn to them, and someone else would be acknowledged as the leader. She didn't add that it was also the reason that the Zelandanya had such high status. Zelandani was a powerful speaker, and Ayla was listening with rapt attention. She wanted to learn as much as she could about the people of the man she was soon to mate, who were now her people. But when she thought about it, the clan were not so different. They also shared everything, and no one went hungry, not even that woman she was told about who died in the earthquake. She had come from another clan, never had children, and after her mate died, she had to be taken as a second woman, always considered a burden. But although she had the lowest status of anyone in Brun's clan, she never went hungry and always had warm enough clothing. The clan knew all those things. They didn't have to express it with words. The people of the clan were not as full of words as the others. Mates were shared, too. They understood about relieving a man's needs. No clan woman ever refused any man who gave her the signal. She didn't know anyone who even thought of refusing, except her. But she knew now that what Braud wanted was not pleasures. She even knew it then, though she couldn't express it. He didn't give her the signal because he wanted to share the gift or to relieve his needs. He did it only because he knew she hated it. "Remember," the Danyer was saying, "it is your mate who must help you and provide for you and your children, especially when you are heavy with child or have just given birth and are nursing. If you care about him, if you have shared pleasures with him often and kept him reasonably content, most men are more than happy to provide for their mates and her children. Perhaps some of you can't imagine why I should make this point so strongly. Ask your mothers. When you are busy and tired with many children, there may come a time when the gift is not so easy to share, and there are times when it should not be shared, but I'll talk about that later." Dani is always more pleased and smiles with favor on those children who bear some resemblance to your mate. Mates, too, often feel closer to those children. If you want your children to resemble your mate, you must spend time together, so it will be his spirit that will be the easiest to be selected. The ways of the spirits are willful. There is no way to tell when one will decide to allow itself to be chosen, or when the mother will decide it is time to blend them. But if you enjoy each other and are pleased with each other, your mate will want to stay with you, and his spirit will be happy to join with yours. Does everyone understand so far? If you have questions, now is the time to speak of them, the first said, looking around and waiting.
But what if I get sick or something and can't feel any pleasure in the gift? A woman asked.
Others turned to look, to see who had asked. Your mate should be understanding of that, and it is always your choice in any case. There are some who are mated and seldom share the gift with each other. If you are kind and understanding of your mate, he will usually be the same to you. Men are children of the mother, too. They get sick, and usually it's their mates who care for them. Most mates will try to care for you when you are sick, too.
The young woman nodded and smiled rather tentatively.
What I'm saying is that couples should have consideration and show kindness and respect for each other. The gift of pleasure can bring happiness to both of you and help to make your mate feel happy and contented so the union will last. Any other questions?
The first waited to see if anyone else had any more questions, then continued.
But mating is more than two people choosing to live together. It involves your kin, your cave, and the world of the spirits as well. That is why mothers and their mates consider carefully before they allow their children to mate. With whom will you live? Will you and your mate be a worthy addition to the cave you live with? Your feelings for each other are also important. If you start without caring, the union may not last. If the union does not last, the responsibility for any children usually falls to the mother's kin and cave, as it does if both of you should die. Ayla was fascinated by the discussion. She almost asked a question about the blending of spirits starting life. She was more than ever convinced that it was the gift of pleasures itself that was necessary for life to begin, but she decided not to mention it here. Now, Zelandani continued, while most of you will be eagerly looking forward to your first baby, there may come a time when a life has started that should not have started. Until you have received the Elandan of your infant from your Zelandani, it has no spirit of its own, only the combined spirits that started it. At that time, the Great Earth Mother will accept the infant, separate the spirits, and give them back. But it is better to stop the continuation of life before it is ready to be born, best within the first 3 moons of pregnancy.
Why would anyone want to stop a new life that has started?
A young woman asked.
Shouldn't all babies be welcomed?
Most babies are welcomed, the Zelandani said. But there may be reasons why a woman should not have another. Though it doesn't happen often, she may get pregnant again while she's still nursing and give birth to another baby when she has one that is still very young. Most mothers cannot adequately care for another baby so soon. The one who is already here and named, particularly if it is healthy, must come first. Too many young ones die as it is, especially in their first year. It is unwise to risk the life of a child who is healthy and growing by forcing her from the breast too soon. After surviving the first year, weaning is the next most difficult time for a child. If a baby must be weaned too soon, less than 3 years, it can weaken the child and the person they grow into. It is better to have one healthy child that will grow into a strong adult than 2 or 3 weak ones who may not live long.
Oh, I didn't think of that, the young woman said.
Or, as another example, perhaps a woman has given birth to several seriously malformed children who have died. Should she continue carrying full term and have to go through such sorrow each time? Not to mention weakening herself.
But what if she really wants a baby like everyone else? Said a young woman with tears in her eyes.
All women do not have children, Zelandani said. Some choose not to. With others, life never starts. Some can't seem to carry full term, or have stillborn children, or children that are so malformed they don't live, or they shouldn't.
But why? The tearful woman asked.
No one knows why. Perhaps someone who has something against her has cursed her. Perhaps an evil spirit found a way to harm the unborn baby. It even happens to animals. We've all seen malformed horses or deer. Some say that white animals are the result of an evil spirit that was thwarted. That's why they are lucky. People, too, are sometimes born white with pink eyes. Animals, no doubt, have stillborns and young that don't live as well, though I suspect carnivores take care of them so quickly we don't see them. That's just the way it is, Zelandani said.
The young woman was in tears, and Ayla wondered why the Danyer seemed so unemotional in her response.
Her sister has had difficulties having a baby, and she's been pregnant 2 or 3 times, Velima said under her breath. I think she's afraid the same thing will happen to her. It's wise of Zelandani not to build up false hopes. Sometimes it runs in families, Marthona murmured in return. And if she has a child, she'll be all the happier for it. Ayla watched the young woman and was so moved she couldn't resist speaking out. On our way here, she began. Everyone turned to look in surprise at the newcomer who spoke out, and many noticed her speech difference. Jandalar and I stopped at a Los Adunai cave. There was a woman there who had never been able to have children. A woman from a nearby cave had died, leaving her mate with 3 young children. The woman who couldn't have any went to live with them to see if they could work out a compatible arrangement. If they could, she was going to adopt the children and take the man for a mate. There was silence for a time, then an undercurrent of conversation. That's a very good example, Ayla, Zelandani said. It's true. Women can adopt children. Did this childless woman have a mate of her own? No, I don't think so, Ayla replied. Even if she had, she could have brought him with her, if the men were willing to accept each other as co-mates. An extra man to help provide for those children could be helpful. Ayla has made a good point. Women who are not able to give birth to their own children don't always have to remain childless, Zelandani said. Then she went on. There are other reasons a woman may choose to end a pregnancy. A mother may have too many children, making it difficult for her to care for them all, and for her, her mate, and her cave to provide for them. Often women who are in that situation don't really want more, and wish the mother wouldn't be quite so generous with them.
I know a woman who kept having children, another young woman said.
After Ayla spoke out, others weren't so hesitant about it.
She gave 2 to her sister and 1 to a cousin to adopt.
I know the one you mean. She seems to be a particularly strong and healthy woman who likes being pregnant and has little trouble giving birth. She's very fortunate. And she's done a great service for her sister who was unable to have children, I believe, because of an accident, and for her cousin who wanted another without carrying it herself, the large woman said, then turned the talk back to the subject. But not all women are as capable or that lucky. Some women have such a difficult childbirth with 1 or more, another child may kill them and leave their living children without a mother. Everyone is different. Fortunately, most women are able to have children, but even they may not want, or should not bring, every pregnancy to term. There are several things that can be done to stop a pregnancy. Some can be dangerous. A strong tea made from an entire tansy plant, root and all, can bring on bleeding, but it can be fatal. A shaved slippery elm stick inserted deeply into the opening from which the child is born can be very effective, but it is always best to talk to your danyer, who will know how strong a tea to make or how to insert the stick. There are other measures. Your mother's or your Zelandanya will discuss them with you in greater detail if and when you want to know more. The same is true of childbirth. There are many medicines that can speed delivery, stop hemorrhaging, and ease the pain. There's almost always some pain with childbirth, the first said. The great mother herself struggled in pain, but most women have little trouble, and the pain is soon forgotten. Everyone must bear some pain in her life. It's a part of living. There's no escape from it. It is best to accept it. Ayla was interested in the medicines Zelandani talked about, although the ones she mentioned were relatively simple and well-known. Almost every woman she talked with about it had learned some way to end a pregnancy, though some seemed more dangerous to her than others. Men often didn't like the idea, and Issa and the other medicine women of the clan had kept it secret from the men, or they would have forbidden it. The Danyer had not talked about preventing life from getting started, and Ayla very much wanted to talk to her about that, and perhaps compare notes. Ayla had been midwife at several births. It suddenly occurred to her that she would soon be giving birth herself again. Yes, Zelandani was right. Pain was a part of living. She had endured great pain in giving birth to Durk. She had almost died, but like the mother's great shining sun, he had been worth it. There is more than physical pain in life, Zelandani was saying. Ayla turned her attention back to the woman. Some pain is worse than physical, but you must accept that, too. As a woman, you have a great responsibility and a duty that may at times be difficult, but one that you may have to consider some day. There are times when the life you carry is very tenacious, when nothing is able to prevent the pregnancy from progressing, even though you may have decided the life should not have begun. It is always more difficult after the child is born to return it to the mother, but there are times when it must be done. Remember, the ones who are already here must come first. If a second one is born too soon, or is greatly malformed, or other valid reasons, the infant should be returned to Dani. It is the mother's choice always, but you must remember your responsibility, and it must be done quickly. As soon as you're able, you must take it outside and lay it on the breast of the Great Earth Mother, as far away as possible from your home, and never near a sacred burial ground or a wandering spirit may try to inhabit the body. Then the spirit will become confused and not be able to find its way to the next world. Such spirits can become evil. Is there anyone here who does not understand exactly what I just said? This was always a very difficult moment in the pre-mating meeting, and Zelandani allowed some time for the young women to comprehend the harsh revelation, but they had to understand it and accept it. No one spoke. The young women had heard rumors and talked among themselves about the distressing duty they might be called upon to perform some day. But this was the first time it had been brought up to them directly. Each young woman there hoped fervently that they would never have to expose a baby to the cold breast of the Great Earth Mother to die. It was a somber thought. A few of the older women sat tight-lipped with pain in their eyes, because theirs had been that awful duty to preserve the life of one by giving up another. Though it was still not an easy decision, most women would far rather end a pregnancy early than lose a child to whom she had given birth, or worse, to have to do it herself. Zelandani's comments devastated Ayla. She would never be able to, she thought. Memories of Durk flooded back. He was supposed to have been exposed, and she had no say in it. She recalled with anguish the days spent hiding in the little cave to save his life. They had said he was deformed, but he wasn't. He was just a mixture of her and Braud, although Braud was the first to condemn him. If Braud had known every time he forced me that Durk would be the result, Ayla thought, he would never have done it. Ayla was tempted to ask why life was not prevented from starting in the first place, but she didn't trust herself to speak. Marthona was puzzled by the obvious distress Ayla was feeling. True, it was not an easy thought to bear, but Ayla's coming baby had little likelihood of having to be given back to the mother. Maybe it's just that she's pregnant. She must be very sensitive, she thought. There was not much more information to impart. Prohibitions on sharing the gift of pleasure when a woman was close to delivery, for a certain period of time afterward, and before, during, or after certain ceremonies. Other duties of a mated woman, the times when it was necessary to fast, other times when certain foods were not to be eaten. There were also bans against mating with certain people, such as close cousins. Jandalar had explained about close cousins, and when it was mentioned, she had glanced at Joplea in the unobtrusive, all but unseen way of clan women. She knew the reason for the aura of sadness that shrouded the beautiful young woman, but she'd heard several people mention kinship signs since they arrived at the summer meeting, and she didn't know what they were talking about.
What did it mean to have an incompatible kinship sign? The other women knew all about bans and prohibitions, and she didn't want to say anything in front of them. She decided to wait until most people left before she asked her question. "There is one other thing," the first said, concluding. "Some of you may have already heard that a request was received to delay the matrimonial a few days." There was a moan of regret from a few of the women. Dalinar and his cave of Lanzadanyi planned to come to the Zelandanyi summer meeting so the daughter of his mate could be mated at our first matrimonial. There was whispering and murmuring from the assembly. "You may be pleased to know that no delay will be necessary. Joplea is here with her mother, Jerrica. Joplea and Echazar will be mated with the rest of you. Remember everything that was spoken of here. It is important. The beginning hunt of this summer meeting will start tomorrow morning, and if all goes well, the matrimonial will follow soon after. I will see you all then," said the one who was first. As the meeting was breaking up, Ayla heard the word flathead a few times and abomination at least once. It did not please her, but it was obvious that many were eager to leave and tell someone else about the fact that Joplea was promised to the half-flathead man, Echazar. Many of the women remembered him. He had come to their summer meeting once before, the last time that the Lanzadanyi came. Marthona remembered that there had been some unpleasantness concerning Echazar and his mixed spirits at that meeting, and she hoped it would not come up again. It reminded her of the other summer meeting that was unpleasant for her, the one that Jondalar had missed when he went on his journey with his brother and left Morona waiting for a matrimonial partner that did not arrive. She did mate that summer at the second matrimonial, just before they went home, but it didn't last. Now Morona was again available, but Jondalar had brought a woman home with him, a woman that was far better suited to her son for all her foreign ways, if only because she genuinely cared for him, and he loved her. Zelandani had a passing thought of forbidding the women from talking about anything that was said at the meeting, but she knew there was no way to enforce such an edict. It was just too juicy a piece of news to expect people to keep it to themselves. The first noticed that Ayla and those with her did not seem to be in a hurry and were perhaps waiting to talk to her. She was still Zelandani of the Ninth Cave. When nearly everyone except the Zelandanya was gone, Ayla approached her.
"I have something I'd like to ask you, Zelandani," she said.
"All right," the woman said.
"You were talking about certain bans and prohibitions, people that you could or could not mate. I know that someone can't mate a close cousin. Jondalar told me that Joplea is his close cousin. Sometimes he says hearth cousin, because they were both born to the hearth of the same man," Ayla said. She avoided looking at Joplea, but Marthona and Jerrica glanced at each other.
"That's correct," Zelandani of the Ninth said.
"Just since we arrived at the summer meeting, I've been hearing people talk about something else. You did, too. You said a person shouldn't mate someone with an incompatible kinship sign. What is a kinship sign?"
Ayla asked. The other Zelandanya had listened for a while, but when it appeared that Ayla was just asking for information, they began talking quietly amongst themselves or going to their personal space within the lodge.
"That is a little more difficult to explain," Zelandani said. "A person is born with a kinship sign. In a way, it's part of one's elan, one's life force. People know their kinship signs almost from the time they are born, just as they know their elandan. Remember, all animals are children of the mother. She birthed them too, as it says in the mother's song.
With a thunderous roar, her stones split asunder. And from the great cave that opened deep under, she birthed once again from her cavernous room, and brought forth the children of earth from her womb. From the mother forlorn, more children were born. Each child was different. Some were large and some small. Some could walk and some fly, some could swim and some crawl. But each form was perfect, each spirit complete. Each one was a model whose shape could repeat. The mother was willing. The green earth was filling. The kinship sign is symbolized by an animal, by the spirit of an animal,
Zelandani said.
You mean like a totem?
Ayla interjected.
My totem is the cave lion. Everyone in the clan has a totem.
Perhaps, the first said, considering thoughtfully for a moment. But I think totems are something else. Not everyone has one, for one thing. They are important, but they're not quite as important as an elan, for example, though it is true that one must go through some trial or struggle to gain a totem. Usually, you are chosen by a totem, but everyone has a kinship sign, and many people have the same sign. A totem can be any animal spirit, a cave lion, a golden eagle, a grasshopper, but certain animals have a kind of power. Their spirits have a force of a certain kind, like a life force, but it's different. The Zelandanya call them power animals, but they have more force in the next world than in this one. Sometimes we can draw upon that force for protection when we travel in the spirit world, or to cause certain things to happen, the one who was first said. Ayla was frowning with concentration, trying to remember something.
The mammoth did that, she said. I remember at a ceremony he made strange things happen. I think he took a piece of the spirit world and brought it into this one, but he had to fight to control it.
Zelandani's expression showed her surprise and admiration. I think I would have liked to know your mammoth, she said. Then she continued. Most people don't think too much about their kinship signs, except when they're thinking about mating. One should not mate with someone whose kinship sign is in opposition to theirs, which is probably why it's brought up more at summer meetings, where matings are planned and mating ceremonies, matrimonials, take place. That's why the common name for one's power animal is a kinship sign. The name is misleading, but it's how most people think of it because they don't deal with the spirit world, and the only time it has a bearing on their lives is when planning to mate.
No one has asked me about the kinship signs,
Ayla said. It only has meaning for one who was born a Zelandanyi. Those who are born elsewhere may have kinship signs or power animals, but they don't affiliate with Zelandanyi power animals as a rule. Once a person becomes a Zelandanyi, a kinship sign may assert itself, but it will never be one that is in opposition to the mate she already has. The power animal of her mate won't let it.
Marthona, Jerrica, and Joplea were listening just as intently. Jerrica had not been born Zelandanyi, and she was curious about the customs and beliefs of her mate.
We are Lanzadanyi, not Zelandanyi. Does that mean if a Lanzadanyi wants to mate with a Zelandanyi, the kinship signs don't matter?
In time they may not, but many of you, including Dalinar, were born Zelandanyi. The ties are still close, so they do have to be considered,
the first said.
I was never a Zelandanyi, but now I am Lanzadanyi, so is Joplea. Since Echazar was not born to either one, it doesn't matter, but doesn't a daughter get her kinship sign from her mother? What is Joplea's kinship sign?
Jerrica asked.
Usually, a daughter has the same kinship sign as her mother, but not always. I understand that you have requested a Zelandani to move to your cave and become your first Lanzadani. I think it will be a wonderful opportunity for someone. Whoever it is will be well-trained, I plan to make sure of that, and will be able to discover the kinship signs for all your people,
the Danyer said.
What is Jondalar's kinship sign, and how can I get one to give to my daughter, if I have one?
Ayla asked. If you want to find out, we can look into it. Jondalar's power animal is a horse, like Marthona,
But though he has the same mother, Joharan's is different. His is a bison. Bison and horses are in opposition, Zelandani said.
But Jandalar and Joharan don't oppose each other. They get along well,
Ayla said with a frown. The big woman smiled.
For mating, Ayla. They are opposing kinship signs.
Oh, I guess they're not likely to mate, she said, and smiled too. You said they are power animals. Since my totem is the cave lion, do you think that would be my power animal? He is powerful, and his spirit has protected me before.
Things are different in the spirit world, the first said. Power means different things. Meat-eaters are powerful, but they tend to keep to themselves, either alone or in small packs, and other animals stay away from them. When you enter the spirit world, it is usually because you need to learn something, to find something out. The animal that can reach farther, that has access to, maybe I should say that can communicate with, many other animals, has more power, or more useful power. It depends what you go there for. Sometimes you do want to seek out meat-eating animals because of their special qualities.
Why are a bison and a horse opposing kinship signs?
Ayla asked. Probably because in this world they tend to cover the same ground at different times, so there is some overlap, some competition for food. Aurochs, on the other hand, eat the tender new greens, or just the green tops, of the grasses, leaving behind the stalks and roughage, which horses seem to prefer. So they are compatible. The two most opposing power animals are bison and aurochs. But when you think about it, it is logical. Most plant-eaters tolerate each other, but bison and aurochs can't stand to be in the same meadow. They avoid each other and have been known to fight, especially when females come into the season of their pleasures. They're too similar. Aurochs bulls are affected when they smell a bison female in heat, and bison bulls will occasionally go after a female aurox. Someone with an aurox kinship sign should never mate someone with a bison sign, Zelandani said.
What is your power animal, Zelandani?
Ayla asked. You should almost be able to guess, the woman said, smiling. I am a mammoth when I go into the spirit world. When you go, Ayla, you will not look the same as you do here. You will go as your power animal. That's when you will find out what it is. Ayla wasn't sure she liked hearing Zelandani talking about her going into the spirit world. But Marthona wondered why Zelandani was being so forthcoming. She didn't usually go into such detailed and in-depth answers. Jandalar's mother had the distinct sense that Zelandani was trying to tempt Ayla, to entice her with fascinating bits of knowledge that were available only to those in the Zelandanya. Then she understood. Ayla was already considered by most people to be some kind of Zelandani, and the first wanted her on the inside, where she could exercise some control, not out of her reach, where she could create problems. But Ayla had already declared that she wanted only to get mated and have children and be like everyone else. She didn't want to join the Zelandanya, and knowing her son, Marthona realized that he wouldn't particularly want her to be Zelandani either. But he did have a tendency to be attracted to women who were. It was going to be an interesting game to watch. They were getting ready to go, but as they were leaving, Ayla turned back.
I have another question, she said. When you were talking about babies and causing miscarriages to end an unwanted pregnancy, why did you not say something about preventing the life from starting in the first place?
There is no way. Only Donnie has the power to begin life, and only she can prevent it from starting,
Zelandani of the 14th said. She had been standing nearby, listening to the conversation.
But there is, Ayla said.
Chapter 29. The first gave the young woman a sharp look. Perhaps she should have spoken with Ayla earlier in more depth. Was it possible she knew of a way to thwart the will of Donnie? This was the wrong way to bring it up, but it was too late now. The Zelandanya, who were standing nearby, were talking loudly and gesticulating among themselves. Some were just as agitated as the 14th. A few were saying it was wrong. The rest were coming back to the central area to find out what was going on. Ayla didn't know her statement would cause such a stir. The three women with her were standing back and watching. Marthona looked on with sardonic amusement, though her expression remained neutral. Joplea was astounded that the esteemed Zelandanya could quarrel so ardently, but was just as shocked as they were. Jerrica listened with great interest, but she had already decided to speak with Ayla in private. Her announcement to the Zelandanya could be the solution to a serious problem that had been worrying the woman for some time. When she first met him, Jerrica had fallen completely and irrevocably in love with the handsome giant of a man who was so charmed by the exquisitely dainty yet fiercely independent young woman. He was a gentleman and consummate lover in spite of his size, and she reveled in their pleasures. When he asked her to be his mate, she accepted without hesitation, and when she discovered that she was pregnant, she was delighted. But the baby she carried was too big for her tiny frame, and the delivery nearly killed her and her daughter. It damaged her internally, and she never became pregnant again, much to her regret and relief. Now her daughter had chosen a man who was, though not as tall, if anything, more robust, with powerful muscles and huge bones. Though Joplea was tall, she was thin and rather delicate with, Jerrica had carefully noticed, narrow hips. From the time she realized who her daughter would probably end up choosing, and therefore be the one whose spirit would most likely be chosen by the mother to start any children she might have, she worried that Joplea would suffer her fate or worse. She suspected that Joplea was already pregnant, since she had started having violent bouts of morning sickness on the trip, but she refused her mother's suggestion to end the pregnancy. Jerrica knew there was nothing she could do about it. It was the Great Mother's decision. Joplea would be blessed or not, when she wished, and live or die at her discretion. But Jerrica suspected that with the man Joplea had chosen, the chances were that her daughter would die young and painfully in childbirth. If not with the first, then later with another one. Her only hope was that her daughter would live through this first one and, like herself, as painful as it was, be damaged so badly she would never be able to get pregnant again. Until she heard Ayla say that she knew how to prevent life from starting. She immediately decided that if her daughter had as much trouble as she did and managed to live through the birth of her first to save her life, she would make sure Joplea would not get pregnant again. "Quiet, please," the one who was first said. The noise finally settled down. "Ayla, I want to make sure I understand you. Are you saying you know how to stop a pregnancy before it starts? That you know how to prevent life from beginning?" she asked.
"Yes, I thought you would know, too. I was using certain plants on my journey from the east with Jandalar. I did not want to have a baby while we were traveling. I had no one to help me," she said.
"You told me that you were already blessed by Donnie. You said it has been 3 moons since your last bleeding. You were still traveling then," the Danya said.
"I'm almost certain this baby was started after we crossed the glacier," Ayla said. "We brought only enough of the Los Adunai burning stones to melt ice for water to drink for the horses and wolf and the two of us. I did not even try to boil water for tea and did not prepare my usual morning drink. It was a very difficult crossing, and we almost didn't make it. When we reached this side and got down off the ice, we stayed and rested for a while, and I didn't bother to make the preparation. By that time, it didn't matter if life started. We were almost here. I was happy when I realized I was pregnant."
"Where did you learn about this medicine?" Zelandani asked.
"From Issa, the medicine woman who raised me."
How did she say it worked? Zelandani of the 14th asked. The first looked at her, trying to contain her annoyance. She was asking questions in a logical sequence. She didn't need help or interference, but Ayla answered anyway.
The clan believes that the spirit of a man's totem fights the spirit of a woman's totem, and that is why she bleeds. When the man's totem is stronger than a woman's, it defeats hers and begins the new life. Isa told me that certain plants could make a woman's totem strong and help her totem's spirit fight off the man's, she explained.
Primitive, but I'm surprised they have ideas about it at all, the 14th said, and got a hard stare from the first.
Ayla heard the disdain in her tone and was glad now that she hadn't said anything earlier about a man starting a baby inside a woman. She didn't think it was a blending of spirits by Donnie any more than it was a defeated totem, but she thought the 14th, or someone else, would probably find her thoughts more worthy of criticism than consideration.
You said you used the plants on your journey. What made you think the medicine would work?
The first asked, taking control of the questions again.
Men of the clan put great value on the children of their mates, particularly if they are boys. When their mate has a child, it adds to their prestige. They believe it shows the vigor of their totem, which is, in a sense, their inner strength. Isa told me she used the plants herself for many years to keep from getting pregnant because she wanted to bring disgrace upon her mate. He was a cruel man who beat her to show his authority over a medicine woman of her rank. So she decided to show that his totem spirit wasn't strong enough to defeat hers, Ayla said.
Why would she put up with such behavior? The 14th interjected again. Why didn't she just sever the knot and find another mate?
Women of the clan have no choice in whom they mate. It is decided by the leader and the other men, Ayla explained.
No choice, the 14th sputtered.
Under the circumstances, I'd say it showed a great deal of subtle intelligence on the part of the woman. What was her name? Isa? The first said quickly, before the 14th could butt in and ask another question.
Do all the women of the clan know about these plants?
No, only medicine women, and I think this preparation was known only to women of Isa's line, but she gave the preparation to some of the other women if she thought they needed it. I don't know if she told them what it was, though. If any of the men had found out, they would have been very angry, but no one would ask Isa. A medicine woman's knowledge is not for men to know. It is passed down to her daughters, who would become medicine women themselves if they showed the inclination. Isa thought of me as her daughter, Ayla said.
I am very surprised at the sophistication of their medicine, Zelandani said, knowing she was speaking for many of the others.
Mahmut of the Lion Camp understood how effective their medicine was. He went on a journey when he was young and broke his arm quite badly. He stumbled into the cave of a clan, and the medicine woman there set his arm and nursed him back to health. We both believed it was the same clan as the one I lived with. The woman who healed him was Isa's grandmother.
There was total silence in the tent when Ayla finished. What she said was very difficult to believe. The Zelandanya of the nearby caves had heard Joharan and Jandalar talk to people about the Flatheads, whom Ayla said called themselves the clan, and were people, not animals. There had been much discussion about it the next few days, but most dismissed the idea. Flatheads might be a little more clever than most people thought, perhaps, but hardly human. Now this woman was saying that they had healed a man of the Mamutoi and had thought about how life began. She even implied that their medicinal practices might be more advanced than those of the Zelandanyi. The Zelandanya started discussing these issues again, and the commotion inside the tent could be heard outside. The male Zelandanya, who had been guarding the women's meeting, were dying of curiosity to find out what was causing the uproar, but were waiting to be invited back in.
They knew there were still a few women inside, but it was most unusual for a women's meeting to become so heated. The first had heard Ayla speak in depth of the clan before, and was quicker to grasp the implications and to extend them. She was now persuaded that they were people, and believed it was important for the Zelandanyi to understand the possible consequences, but even she had not realized how advanced they were. Zelandani had presumed a simpler, more primitive way of life, and believed that their medicine was at a similar level. She felt that Ayla had gained some good basic instruction that she could develop. This called for a reevaluation. Their own histories harked back to a time when the Zelandani lived a simpler life, but their comprehension of vegetable foods and medicines had been more advanced than other kinds of knowledge. She suspected that awareness of plants was older, went back further. If the clan was as ancient as Ayla seemed to think, it was not beyond the realm of possibility that their knowledge could be quite developed, especially if it was true, as Ayla had indicated, that they had some kind of special memory they could draw on. Zelandani wished that she had spoken with Ayla before it was brought up to the Zelandanya, but perhaps it was best this way. It might take just such a shock to make the Zelandanya realize the full impact that the people Ayla knew as the clan could have on them. "Let's be quiet, please," Zelandani said, trying to settle them down again. When order was finally restored, she made an announcement. "It appears that Ayla has brought us some information that may be very useful. The Mamutoi were very perceptive when they adopted her to the hearth of the mammoth, which was, in effect, the same as being adopted by the Zelandanya. We will speak with her in some depth later and explore the extent of her knowledge. If she does in truth know of ways to prevent the start of life, this could be a great benefit, and we should be grateful to have it."
"I should tell you that it doesn't always work," Ayla interjected. "Isa's mate died when an earthquake collapsed their cave, but she was pregnant when she found me. Her daughter Uba was born not long after, but Isa could count 20 years by then, very old for a woman of the clan to have a first child. Their girls become women at 8 or 9 years, but the medicine worked for her for many years, and it worked for me for most of my journey."
"Very little of the knowledge of medicine or healing is absolutely certain," Zelandani said. "In the end, it is still the Great Mother who decides." Jondalar was glad to see the women returning. He had been waiting for Ayla. He had stayed at their camp with Wolf when Dalinar went to the main camp with Joharan and had promised that he would meet them as soon as Ayla returned. Marthona had told Falara to have some hot tea and a little food ready for them, and invited Jerrica and Joplea to their lodge. Marthona and Jerrica talked about mutual friends and relations, and Falara started telling Joplea about some activities the younger people were planning. Ayla joined them for a while, but after the rather contentious ending to the meeting in the Zelandanya lodge, she felt a need to go off by herself. Saying that she wanted to check on the horses, she picked up her haversack and left with Wolf. She walked upstream along the creek, visited with the horses for a while, then continued on until she came to the pool. She was tempted to go for a swim, but decided to keep on walking instead. She proceeded along a newly developing path, and when she found herself near the new cave, she realized that she had gone the way that Jondalar and the others had come before. As she approached the small hill that held the cave, she could see the mouth clearly, and noticed that the obstructing brush had been cleared away. Dirt and stones around the opening had also been removed, which enlarged the entrance. It was likely that nearly every one of the people at the summer meeting of Zelandanyi had been inside the new cave at least once by now, but there was little evidence to show for the visits. Because it was so beautiful and so unusual with its nearly white stone walls, it was considered a very sacred place and rather inviolable. The Zelandanya and cave leaders were still getting accustomed to it, working out the appropriate times and ways to use it. Traditions hadn't been developed yet. It was too new. The spot where she had made a small fire to light torches and left charcoal remains had become a fireplace with stones encircling it and a few partially burned torches nearby. She removed her fire-making kit from her pack, quickly kindled a fire, and lit one of the torches, then walked to the entrance of the cave. Holding the torch high, she stepped inside the dark space. The sunlight coming in through the entrance lit the soft dirt floor of the sloping entry corridor, which had acquired an accumulation of footprints of all sizes, both bare and in footwear. She saw an imprint of a long, narrow, bare foot, probably of a tall man, another of average size and slightly wider, the foot of either a grown woman or a growing boy. There was the sole of a sandal woven of grass or reeds. Near it, the blurred outline of a leather moccasin, then a line of the widely spaced, rather unsteady, tiny footprints of a toddler just learning to walk. On top of them was the paw print of a wolf. Ayla wondered what a tracker, unaware of the animal that walked ahead of her into the cave, would make of that. She felt the air become cool and damp, and the space darken as she proceeded underground. The cave did not require feats of agility to get into, at least to the large main room. This was a cave that whole families would use, but not as a living space. Underground caves were too dark and damp to live in, especially when the region was full of shelters open to daylight, with level floors and overhanging stone ledges above to protect them from rain and snow. And this cave was so beautiful. It felt like a special sanctuary, an extraordinary entrance to the womb of the mother. She and Wolf walked along the left side of the large room with the white walls. Then she went into the narrow gallery at the back, with the walls that widened out as they rose and came together in the curved white ceiling. She stepped down into the widened area around the round column, which came down from the roof but didn't reach the floor. She was beginning to feel cold and reached into her pack to take out the soft leather hide of a giant deer and put it around her shoulders. It was from the deer that she had brought down with her spear-thrower before the bison hunt that killed Chevenar. So much had happened since then, it felt like it was long ago. But it wasn't, she thought. She walked to the end of the narrow corridor after it turned around the hanging pier, then came back and sat down. She liked the roominess of the space. Wolf came and rubbed his head against her free hand.
"I think you want some attention," she said, shifting her torch to her left hand and scratching behind his ears.
When he left to explore again, her mind wandered back to the meeting earlier with the other women who were going to be mated, and the Zelandanya, and the discussions after most of the other women left. She thought about kinship signs and remembered that Marthona's was the horse and wondered what hers was. She found it interesting that in the spirit world, horses and aurochs and bison were power animals that were more important than wolves or cave lions, or probably cave bears. It was a place where things were reversed, backwards, maybe inside out or upside down. As she sat there, a feeling started to come over her, a feeling that she'd had before. She didn't like it and tried to fight it, but she had no control over it. She seemed to be remembering something, remembering her dreams. But it was more than memory, and more than dreamlike. It was as though she were reliving her dreams and memories with a vague